right? That's what we do at the Commonwealth Club. And welcome to all those who are listening on the radio broadcast. I'm going to give you a sense of what we're going to be doing tonight, and I'm excited that you're here. Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Inforum, the Commonwealth Club's Innovation Lab. You can find Inforum online at inforumsf.org. I'm Chip Conley, head of Global Hospitality and Strategy at Airbnb and founder of SFest 300. I'm your host and moderator for this evening. And tonight we're here for Inforum's event, Your Guide to Festivals Live. So we're going to spend the evening starting with me doing a very short presentation about some of my perspective on why festivals are making such a comeback in the 21st century. And then I'm so excited to invite three of my friends to the stage. Marion Goodell, the founding board member and CEO of Burning Man. The hardly strictly bluegrass founder and producer, Don Holliday, who really got me in business years ago when we bought the Phoenix and turned it into this rock and roll hotel. She was the first person to start booking bands into my hotel, so I love her. And then George Ridgely, who is not just the SF Pride executive director, but for many years ran operations and marketing for Beta Breakers. So these are three people who know festivals really well. And then we're going to have Q&A from you. And at the end, we'll have a reception out there with some, is there wine or no? And wine and beer and some festival concierges. Festival concierges will actually sit down with you if you'd like and have you take a little test that'll tell you what festival archetype you are and which 12 festivals in the world are best suited for you. So I'm going to ask those people to actually stand up for just a moment. So keep it, and I'll be doing it as well. So take a look for us, and we'll have our laptops with us, and we can tell you which festivals in the world are best suited for you. Make sense? Excited? All right. Yes. All right. This is the time for me to stand up and do my thing. So, and I am going to see if, yeah, I can see the presentation right there. So I'm going to start by telling you a little story. A story that occurred about 13 months ago. It happened, let's make sure this is working. Oh, actually, let me point it that direction. Make sure it's working. All right, there we go. All right. Okay. There we go. It's working now, or that's working.
There you go.
Perfect. So this story is from a year ago. I'm going to tell you in a moment a story from 2 years ago. But a year ago, I went to a tiny village of 500 people in northern Spain, where for 400 years, the 500 villagers have experienced a rite of passage that's part pagan, part Catholic, in which villagers get drunk and they decide to actually jump over mattresses full of babies. 12 to 15 mattresses spread around this village. This is called El Colacho, and it's one of the weirder festivals in the world. Why the hell did Chip Conley go to northern Spain to experience this kind of festival? And this rite of, it really is a rite of passage for the people there. Well, it starts with a year earlier. So I was giving a speech in New York about 2 years ago, and I was on stage. There were 600 people in the audience. It was a speech on emotional intelligence, and at the end of the speech, with 600 people in the audience, I called on a woman in the back, and the first thing she said to me was, "I'm not a stalker," which is not a good way to start with the first thing your Q&A. And I said, "Okay, so what's your question?" And she said, I don't want to talk about emotional intelligence. I want to talk about two things. I want to talk about why is your favorite place in the world Bali, and you've been there 11 times, which was true, and why is it that you're on the board of trustees of the Burning Man project? Why is it that you love Bali and Burning Man so much? Because I love Bali and Burning Man too. So in front of 600 people in New York, I had to stumble through an in-the-moment sense of like, why is it that I love Bali and Burning Man so much? So I started with thinking about Bali. Bali is one endless village festival from the time you're born to the time you die. In fact, your crowning moment of your life is your cremation ceremony at the end of your life. Oops, that's not Bali. But that's not Bali, but that is Bali at the end of your life. In fact, there's fire both at Bali and at Burning Man. Burning Man is also a village festival. It's a village festival that doesn't go your whole life. It's only a week long. But people want it to last their lifetime. And in fact, people come back to the default world talking about their Burning Man experience and how it changed their life. And in many ways, what I learned from Burning Man, having been going for 15 years, is it is really about learning how to, in this modern world, allow your sense of ego separation to evaporate and some sense of communal joy to emerge. And people like that in the 21st century. So on stage, I just started riffing about this, and out of the blue, I just said to this audience of 600 cynical New Yorkers, I want to become the world's leading expert on festivals. And wouldn't that be interesting to go around the world and be a cultural anthropologist and a garden variety hedonist going around and experiencing the world's best festivals? And half the audience gave me a standing ovation. I said, okay, that's what I'm going to do. And so starting soon after that, I said, I'm going to go and learn about why festivals have become such a big, not just a big business in the 21st century, but why are people going and flocking to festivals like never before? And so tonight, in this very short presentation, I'm going to tell you the four reasons why I think festivals are actually making an enormous comeback in the 21st century. But first, let me say that last year, I had the good fortune of going to 35 festivals in 20 countries, which was amazing. And they were all kinds of festivals. What I really wanted to do is say, what are the 300 best festivals of all kinds? Not just music festivals, not just transformational festivals, but film festivals, food festivals, religious pilgrimages, cultural and arts festivals. So I started last year going to this festival, Kumbh Mela, Kumbh Mela in India. How many of you have ever heard of it, Kumbh Mela? A lot of you have. So radio audience, I did a bad thing there. A lot of people raised their hand, just so you know. You don't do that with a radio audience, right? So a lot of people have heard it because it's the largest collection of humanity on Earth. 100 million people come together at the Ganges River every 12 years for this Hindu festival. It's a pilgrimage. And every 3 years, there's actually a smaller version, which is about 50 to 70 million people. So that was an amazing experience of understanding why do people come together? And this has been happening for 2,000 years. Now, that was a collection of 100 million people at the festival El Colacho, which I showed you earlier. That's me in the, for those who aren't seeing it on radio, upper right-hand corner, me with my little camera. This is a festival with 500 people, villagers, and about 12 of us who are actually watching this experience of this thing that's been going on for 400 years. So I went to festivals that were huge and small and everything in between. While in Spain, if you're going to go to this festival, you might as well go to this festival. This is the Running of the Bulls in Pamplona, the Fiesta de San Fermín. It's just one big frat party, frankly. I didn't love this festival. But it did teach me one of the things. If I were to give a gold, a silver, and a bronze to the countries of the world in terms of festivals, it would go to India, Spain, and Japan. And during Q&A later, you could ask me a little bit about why would I give it to those three. But Spain is, you know, vies pretty closely with India as the best in the world for festivals. I also went to this festival, the Whirling Dervish Festival, every single year in December, between December 10th and the 17th in Konya, Turkey, central Turkey. It celebrates, for those who don't know about what Whirling Dervishes do, it's a transcendent experience of Sufi Muslims and started by Rumi. Rumi, the poet that we love so much here in the Bay Area, who is 750 years old, Rumi was the first person to be a whirling dervish. And so there's an annual celebration of the 7 days before he dies. A fascinating experience, especially for an American who's not used to going to a Muslim festival. And then this is a festival in where Siberia and Manchuria come together, the Harbin Ice and Snow Festival. Frickin' cold, really, really, really cold, but one of the more beautiful odes to aesthetics. That taught me a lot about the fact that one of the things we need in our mundane lives today is beauty. So what am I learning from all this? Well, I guess what I learned is we live in an era where our sense of travel and experiencing the world in some ways has been demystified by the internet. You can see El Colacho on video, I took a video of it, and understand what it's like to jump over babies. Now, the truth is, we live in an era where the fact is most people are actually of the mindset that, you know, the world can be seen on right on their computer. But I actually think quite the opposite. That's why people need to go to festivals. And so what I learned is that Emil Durkheim, he's a sociologist from 102 years ago, said that what people look for in festivals and celebrations is collective effervescence. And so that's what I think is fueling a lot of the desire for people to go to festivals today. I have four key things I'm going to tell you very quickly that actually will show you why I think festivals are a living human museum, a window into a living human museum. The first lesson I have is this. I think festivals help to redefine vacation. I hate the word vacation, because for most of us, vacation means we vacate ourselves. We vacate ourselves on vacation. We go from sitting in front of the TV to sitting in front of the view next to the bar at the resort. What's interesting is vacation can allow us to vacate our modern lives and some of our modern conveniences, what we're used to. Vacations can allow us to experience things we haven't experienced before and people we haven't experienced before. If you go to most parts of the world, many people in the world don't call vacation a vacation. Gosh darn it, this is a really bad... the way that a lot of people describe vacations is a holiday. The word holiday has an interesting history to it. It was holy days. It was the time of year when people put down their plows and actually gave celebrations to the gods. Well, holy days is how I think of vacation today, because it's the time where we actually put down our modern conveniences, which are our iPhones, and actually connect with our humanity, with other people. And so I think that's really what happens at a festival, especially at a place like Kumbh Mela, where there was, this is a picture on the Ganges River, where there was no internet. And that was a blessed, you know, we love that at Burning Man, is that there's no internet. So I think it just, festivals are a way for people to actually imagine a holiday, a holy day, where you connect with each other. Secondly, festivals are all about cultural curiosity. Why is that important? We have 7 billion people on the planet today, and within 40 years, we'll have 10 billion people. There's not a lot of elbow room left. So we better get to know the other on the other side of the border. And festivals are great border disintegrators because you get to know the other. Whether getting to know the other is going to a festival in Morocco, predominantly a Muslim festival in Morocco, and being an American and experiencing Islam in a whole different way, or it's being a curious white boy, which is what they called me in my inner city high school when I was growing up, the curious white boy, and going to the Brooklyn Hip Hop Festival and experiencing that. Understanding the other helps create a safer and saner planet, and I promise you being culturally curious makes for a more interesting life. Thirdly, tribal travel. We like birds of a feather flock together. I said flock. So we like to connect with each other. Yeah, some of you got that. I'm sorry. We like to connect with people like ourselves. Yes, yeah, some of us go to a festival for cultural curiosity, but some of us actually go to a festival because we want to connect with each other. And we're in the era we live in today, we usually connect with each other through a URL. But what a festival allows us to do is to connect through an IRL, an in-real-life experience. And tribal travel, whether it's being on a Harley-Davidson in Sturgis, or it's Wanderlust, which is a yoga festival, Comic-Con, which is a geek festival down in San Diego, the Cooper's Hill Cheese Roll, it's a crazy festival for adrenaline junkies in England, or the Festival of the Near-Death Experiences in Spain, you're connecting with people who are part of your tribe. And that's one of the things we look for today. And finally, the fourth point is in an era where McDonald's and Walmart define sort of the global cultural aesthetic, many of us are looking for beauty and aesthetics and transformation from our festivals. This festival here is a festival that's in Thailand, but I went to one that was exactly like this in Taipei. outside of Taipei, the Pingxi Sky Lantern Festival, where people write their hopes and dreams on sky lanterns and then send them all into the sky over the course of 3 or 4 hours together. It's an amazing experience visually and spiritually for people. So to sum up, so I can get my folks up here on stage, festivals are a magnifying glass on life. And whether it's actually donning a mask at a festival, like Venice Carnival, or it's actually stripping your identity down, which people do at Burning Man all the time. And I mean stripping your identity, not necessarily your clothes, although that happens too. Or at Holi, the Holi festival in India, it's throwing colors on each other. Festivals are about experiencing humanity. And they've always been about that. But what's particularly interesting to me about festivals today is something that E.M. Forster said long ago, the writer E.M. Forster. On his deathbed, the last two words he said were these. There we go. Oops, shoot. Gosh. The last two words, actually, if there's a way you could actually just take that last slide up there, they're great. I'm sorry. The last two words E.M. Forster said in his life were, only connect. And I think that's an apt description if I could distill everything I just said into two words. That is why people go to festivals. To only connect. Now, that sounds like a marketing term for AT&T. But I think in this era where the more digital we get, the more ritual we need, only connecting in person is why festivals are getting so big in the 21st century. And it's why, as sort of a cultural anthropologist, I'm fascinated by it. So now I'm excited to bring our three experts to the stage who are going to join me up here. So come on up. So as we said earlier, just to be clear, we are this is the Inforum event, Your Guide to Festivals Live, for those of you on the radio listening to us. And we have on stage here, right next to me to the left, Burning Man Founding Board member and CEO Marion Goodell. We have Don Holliday, the Harvey Strictly Bluegrass founder and producer. And then we have George Ridgely, who is the SF Pride Executive Director and for many years was the Head of Operations and Marketing for Beta Breakers. So frankly, I don't think we could have a better group of people to talk about the subject. And I'm going to ask them some questions, and you can start storing up your questions because we'll have some questions toward the end. So thank you for joining me up here, guys. Let's start with the following. The truth is I have some questions. They already know some of these questions. But when we start talking about this, we end up in some interesting conversations. These are three very visionary Bay Area-based festivals, although obviously Burning Man occurs in the Nevada desert. There was a vision that sort of started the festival. The question I have for you is, how are you a steward of that vision? And with so many constituencies and stakeholders in the vision, how do you actually sleep at night knowing that there's all these different people with different opinions about where your festival should go? Who wants to start?
I'll start.
Yeah. Talk about the vision so people understand how Harley Strictly got started.
Well, it started with Warren Hellman, Sherry Sternberg, who may or may not be here, myself and Jonathan Nelson at a lunch. Warren Hellman, a San Franciscan family, sat down and asked us if we could do a bluegrass festival in the park. He wanted to donate a festival to the city. And we said, yeah. And he said he liked Hazel Dickens. I said, I like Hazel Dickens. Sherry liked Hazel Dickens. I said, but we better have Emmylou Harris so somebody comes.
Yeah.
Because only 13 people would come to hear Hazel. So he said, I like Emmylou Harris. And so that day at lunch, we decided to do a bluegrass festival in the park. The park was very cooperative. They thought this would be great. So we went to the park and looked at it, put up two stages and 13,000 people came. And Warren said, hot dog. And he stood there and said, do you want to do this again next year? And the audience said, yes. So we did it again next year, much to Sherry and I, were surprised. So
how many years ago was this?
13.
13
years. This will be our 14th. And Warren loved it. But he wanted to have the same people back the next year. And we're going, you can't have the same festival. It'll be boring. So we had to add people, which consequently we had to add stages. So we've gotten to be 6 stages, 3 days, and about 800,000 people. And it was because Warren wanted to give a gift to San Francisco. And he also, through the man's life, I watched a man change. I watched a man of 60 who had everything change. I watched music change him. And it was an amazing experience. So I watched bands like Go Go Bordello. I watched bands like the Blind Boys of Alabama. I watched this man whose hole in him was filled by music. He took up banjo. He formed a band. He got good enough to play on a stage. He was never allowed to pick a band because he had terrible taste. By the end, we let him pick 6 bands, and his taste got better. And for us, it was and continues to be the hot dog moments that we got from Warren. So I feel that after Warren passed, his wife Chris is still with us, and the family, it was their 4 children. It wasn't their gig, it was their father's gig. I feel that I want to keep those hot dog moments, and that if I watched a grown man change, who already, I mean, he switched his party affiliations. He was no longer Republican by the end. I feel he went to no party affiliation, though.
Yeah.
And there's many people who take credit for that. Hazel Dickens, Steve Earle. I mean, there's quite a few people who will take credit for that. I feel that I want to do that. And that's what I think we want to preserve, was those hot dog moments. And if it could work with a gentleman like Warren, what can it do for kids? Mm. And what can it do for people? And it's going to remain free. We have a finite amount of money. So we're going to do it as long as we can.
So one question. So is there any arm wrestling about the vision and where it's going?
No.
Okay, you're lucky. Marion, how about the vision at Burning Man?
Oh, dear. Well, I think some people might know that it started on a beach in San Francisco in 1986, and it moved to the desert of northern Nevada in 1990. We had 70,000 people at Burning Man in the Black Rock Desert last year. But the vision now is expanding out into the world. We are actually helping support events that are similar and Burning Man-like in 40 places around the world. We have representatives, and we have leaders, and we have event producers. I think that we kind of estimate maybe 300 or 400,000 people have experienced Burning Man, either in the Black Rock Desert or out in the world. Mm. Mm. What keeps me up at night is actually helping it happen outside of Black Rock City.
Great, great. George, the SF Pride is notoriously political. And there's you cannot satisfy all the queens in Castro. So how do you deal with lots of different opinions?
You have to listen to lots of different opinions. I mean, Pride started in 1970 as a small group of people in Golden Gate Park. This year, we estimate 1.2 million people came to the festival and to the parade. You're right, there's a huge amount of constituencies. It's a member-based organization, so our members are very vocal about what they would like to see in the event. And we try really hard to listen to all those voices and make the event what it is for everyone.
Same with Beta Breakers. I mean, again, that's sort of member-oriented, too. I mean, it's very... In fact, what's interesting about all of these is there are some festivals in the world that are absolutely highly produced, and you just go as sort of an attendee. The truth is many of these are much more... there's a lot of volunteerism, et cetera. Talk about how you think festivals have been evolving over time, and how do you deal with the public assembly issues of having over 1 million people all coming together.
Sure. And with Pride and with Beta Breakers, those events are much more defined by the people who participate in them than by the people who are producing them. Mm-hmm. So we really are the stewards of making sure it's safe and that people have access to everything they need. And it is challenging to... Beta Breakers was not a free event, but Pride is a free event. We strive to keep it a free event. And in doing so, there are no entry gates. There is no entry fee. So it's more challenging to keep crowd control safe and not make it feel, I think your word was Gestapo. That is a fine balance to strike and still keep it safe for people.
Any thoughts on that in terms of just the crowd control as well as the how festivals or your festival is evolving over time?
Well, I think not having fences really helps. Mm-hmm. Ours is free. We don't know what to expect. We prepare for the most and work from there. People seem to take care of each other. We do move barriers. We have wonderful policemen that work with us. We stagger acts. We balance the park as far as the music goes. We do a lot of public assembly work. We prepare with the police department, our own security. We don't sell alcohol, which I think is a really huge factor in the park. You can bring in only to park rules what you can bring in. It's a daytime festival, and it's family-friendly. I think that that matters. Mm-hmm. And also, I just think that it's going to sound corny, but I think the music makes a difference, mm-hmm. that it's still really music-oriented. Mm-hmm. So, but we do prepare, and we do mm-hmm. know when we're going to be moving different paths to different places. Mm-hmm. So,
great.
Yeah.
So, Marion, I'm on the board with you. Thank God I have director's and officer's insurance for Burning Man because, you know, anything can happen there. But how do you keep it safe? How do you keep it sane? And how do you deal with the huge volume of people who want to go to Burning Man and there's only so many tickets to go?
Well, that's two different questions.
Yeah.
keeping it safe and keeping it sane, I don't feel like the organization does as much work on that as the people do. We set up the framework. There are 10 principles, which if you come to Burning Man, it's hard to actually get there without knowing they exist. Mm-hmm. And that sets the framework for the expectations for how people are to treat each other. Mm-hmm. And we don't really, I can't imagine or remember a problem in years that has to do anything to do with the mass of people misbehaving, mm-hmm. Trying to get somewhere across a boundary. I think that it takes a while to get there. The distance is a filter, and you're expected to treat each other well.
It's interesting. So with Burning Man as well as Cumbella, so Cumbella and Burning Man have a lot in common. They're temporary cities. This one's a week long, 70,000 people. Cumbella is 100 million people, 55 days long. And both are being studied by Harvard sociologists, all kinds of different departments from universities around the world about saying, how do you create a temporary village and do it in a fashion where people are participating communally to help support the village? Because especially as disasters happen in the world, you know, maybe Burning Man and Cumbella are a great model for how to deal with an earthquake in a city or a flood, etc. So are you familiar with groups that come and study Burning Man from a sociological perspective?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, we're really supportive of anybody coming to study the event. Catherine Chen has written a really good book. She was at Harvard doing her PhD in sociology and studied us and several angles of what we're doing. We just set the framework for people and how they treat each other. Mm-hmm. You asked about tickets, and a couple of years ago we changed our ticket process so that it was a lottery, and then people were upset for many reasons, but one of them was they expected there to be more new people. Mm-hmm. And so what are you going to do? And I was kind of shocked because my first response was really, what were you going to do as a participant? How are you going to reach out? There's only so many organizers. There's more participants. Mm-hmm. And that's up to the participants to sort of envelop and connect with others.
So I want to ask each of you what you think of that phrase, Emile Durkheim's phrase, the sociologist, collective effervescence, and how does that show up? If you have even a moment that you can think of that defines, in your mind, collective effervescence at your festival. I'm going to let you start, Marian, in terms of how does collective effervescence show up at Burning Man?
Well, there's probably two different events. One is the night the man burns, and the other would be the night of the temple burn. Mm. To me, effervescence is probably not quite as angular and hard-edged as the night the man burns, which is sort of screaming and yelling and
very tribal.
Yeah, very, very tribal. I think the effervescence is sort of bubbly and connective and smooth, and that might be more like the night the temple burns, mm-hmm. when it's very peaceful and people are quiet, and sometimes you can hear the sounds of people of making that bird sounds and sort of twinkling sounds, and you feel very, very connected. The temple burn, you can look across the sea of people and you feel more, you feel like you're one with the others.
So that happens on Sunday night.
It's
and,
on Sunday
and
night.
The man burn is on Saturday,
Saturday night. Yes. It's the downside.
Gone. Well, I already stole it from you and used it yesterday. And I used it as an example of why a band would want to come play who hadn't played before to what they would feel when they played in front of 60,000 people who may or may not have heard them, and the feeling that they would get from the energy from the crowd. Mm. It was a great phrase. So I already stole it from you.
Well, I stole it from Emil.
But it's, to me, it's that energy that mm-hmm. the band and the audience give back and forth between each other. Mm-hmm. And you can feel it. It's incredible. It's like when music changes your life. Mm. And that's how I feel about it. So, so that's where I stole it already.
Perfect. George?
I think that same feeling exists. I've seen it in Pride in a couple of places, but mainly on the parade route, like marching in the parade. I think you've marched in the parade.
I did this year, yes.
There is nothing like walking down Market Street and having 100,000 people cheering you on and smiling and raising their arms and thrilled to see you. Mm-hmm. You feel like you're part of something so much bigger than yourself.
You know, I was just thinking, listening to each of us actually answer that, and in my case, I mentioned almost a particular moment. I think your use of it indicates from the moment you almost enter the space of that festival is the collective effervescence, mm-hmm. and that is what you end up carrying with you. Mm-hmm. So each of these, from the moment you walk onto the field at Hardly Strictly, you start to feel the energy, you hear the music, you want to participate, you want to be one with it. And I've been at Pride also. It's the same way. You get closer to the street. You get the tingling, and you want to march, and you want to raise your hands in the air. It's almost from the minute you start. Mm.
So tell me, what's a festival in the world that you think of as either a role model or a festival that you want this group to know about that exists, that you've loved, that you've experienced? George.
Well, I loved Coachella. I loved Burning Man. I'm jealous you've gone to Harbin. That's on my bucket list of places to go. I went to Lollapalooza. I tend to go to more music festivals, although coming from Beta Breakers and the running industry, I found I had an affinity for running that I did not know. I was not a jock when I was in high school, and I met a lot of jocks over that 10-year period and found out I had a lot more in common with them than I thought. Mm.
Great. Great. Dawn?
I am so totally old. I went to the Real Woodstock.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that, Dawn.
Yeah. And I woke up, that was my first hangover, and I woke up to Carlos Santana and Wavy Gravy. So, what can I say?
I love it.
That's epic.
Yeah.
That's epic.
But this one has been traveling to lots of festivals.
I
just got back from Glastonbury.
I'm a festival geek. I just came back from Glastonbury. 200,000 people inside of a fence line, the same size as Burning Man's. That's pretty epic. I've been to a really beautiful one called Urul, and it's on Terschelling Island in northern Holland.
I
want
to go to that one.
It's beautiful, it is windy, it's cold, there's performance in small spaces, there's outdoor performance in nature, and part of what was charming about it was it was definitely not in my native tongue, but when you have performance, you often can get the message no matter what tongue it's in. And we found ourselves very engaged in several performances we were pulled into without knowing the language. And that, to me, made it really magical.
That festival is on the Fest 300 list, and it's the one on my bucket list of experiences.
It's super sweet.
Yeah, I've heard great things about it. I guess we got, you all gave
us... Yeah, but I would say that your Whirling Dervish Festival.
Oh, yeah.
I was at one in Turkey. It's really, really amazing.
Yeah,
so
yeah, very transcendent. Yeah. Last question before we go to the audience and get some questions from the audience. And they actually would give their questions on the mic stands right there. Is that right? Okay, perfect. So there's some people in the audience here and maybe on the radio audience who are imagining someday they want to be a festival producer. Good idea or bad idea?
You have to be really dedicated to people.
Dedicated to people.
Mm-hmm.
And across, you have to like people?
I personally feel like you have to like people, and I think you have to be in service to the gathering itself.
Mm-hmm.
Because it means so much, and there's so much safety at risk bringing masses of people together. We were just talking about that. That's one of the first things we all think about, that it's probably what keeps us awake at night, at least for me, is the numbers and our safety. But you have to really get high off of the smiles of when people are together, and then you feel like connected to it. Mm. And it's the love of people that inspires.
Don?
I say at this point in my life, if I went back to do it again, with all the politics and costs that are involved, I don't think I'd start it at my age. If I was a younger person, I'd say go for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, follow what you love, but I don't think I'd try to recreate the wheel again.
Yeah.
So.
I think I would say don't fool yourself that it's not a lot of work.
Oh, yeah.
It's a lot of people are like, oh my God, that sounds like so much fun. And it is fun, but it's an immense amount of work.
Tell the audience, how many full-time staff do you have on the Pride staff?
There are three full-time staff.
Three full-time staff on the Pride staff. On the Pride, yeah.
And that was true of Beta Breakers as well.
Yeah.
And how little money you have.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So expect to work.
Yeah. All three festivals have huge numbers of volunteers.
Yep.
Yes.
They're all efforts, like if you have three full-time staff, the efforts and collaboration to make them happen are huge.
So now we're going to open it up to you and give you an opportunity to ask a question. And there's actually someone right here.
Perfect. On?
Yes, it's on.
Okay,
and
perfect.
Just go ahead and stand in line there if you have
a
question.
What a great...
Give us your name if you don't
question.
Mind.
My name is Sherilyn Parsons, and I am the executive director of a brand new book festival coming to San Francisco.
Yes.
And it's called the Bay Area Book Festival. It's modeled on other book festivals around the world, many other cities, L.A., Tucson, Jaipur, India. I was at that festival. They have these big gatherings of authors from around the world, and we haven't had one here for a long time. It's kind of concentrated, in a weekend. So we're aiming for about 150 authors, about a third local, third national, third international. It'll be a weekend in Berkeley in June of next year, 2015. The university is involved, others are involved, and we're actually going pretty big out of the box in terms of the size.
And your question.
Yes,
That's good.
Thank you.
I know you and I, so I feel comfortable saying that to you.
That's great. And the follow-up is just, I was listening eagerly to your response to the last question, just what advice might you have? I mean, even particularly for a literary festival, in getting something off the ground completely from scratch. So far, it's been all volunteers.
Great.
Stumper question.
Light a lot of candles?
That's
literary festivals out of my league.
What do you think, though? I mean, is it how do you figure out who are the evangelists who are going to maybe, give their lives to it?
I'd start with Litquake and start talking to... I'd start with the local resources that are here and work through them.
Yeah, a lot of authors have actually become evangelists, which is terrific.
I think that, if there's a way to figure out who in the Bay Area goes to those book festivals in New York and Frank, doesn't Frankfurt have a big...
Well, Frankfurt Book Fair is more of a trade fair.
So I think trying to figure out who goes to the fairs and the festivals would be a great way.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of reverse engineer it.
Right. Yeah. No. It's
yeah. Who do you want to have enjoy it, or the people that you?
Right.
Can
it's a general public.
Stimulate.
It's free, completely free kind of thing too. So, all right. Well, thank you. It's great to meet all of you and hear this. I really appreciate this session.
And we'll see you at the reception afterwards.
Good luck with your festival.
All right. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Matt Ellsworth. Just wanted to ask if you all maybe tell a story about how you got started in getting people together and into gatherings. It sounded like you used to organize concerts at the Phoenix Hotel as an example. But were there smaller things that you did before you kind of started managing these behemoth events? And what were those things?
Well, I do have Slims in the Great American Music Hall, and I was a box office person for Bill Graham Presents for 14 years. So I started really small. Okay. So, yeah.
I started in the restaurant industry for almost 20 years. And one of the restaurants I worked for did a food and wine festival, which had about 500 people that showed up. And I remember having so much fun coordinating that event. And then moving to San Francisco and going to a street fair every weekend, at some point I was like, I want to experience this from another perspective on the other side of the barricade, basically.
Marianne?
Gosh.
You were a youngster when you got first involved with Burning Man.
My first burn was 20 years ago, and I was an attendee, and there were about 4,000 people there that year. I went, and the next year was 8,000. And I remember wanting to help as a volunteer. And so my initial involvement was as a volunteer as the event was growing from about 10,000 people. I think I kind of knew I wanted to help. I had helped with a national organization of women, had done a march in San Francisco, and I'd been a volunteer for NOW. And I'd been helped on the street and organizing people. And I just felt that feeling that from a perspective, like with all of us, if you can organize something sort of at sort of a medium size and you can and you have enough common sense, you can help scale it.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Ajesh. I have two questions. One, as a joke, do you have any Burning Man tickets?
She has some of her staff here.
There are several Burning Man staff members here, so you can go hit them up.
But on a serious note, how does technology and social media contribute or detract from your festivals or from festivals, and where do you see the future of the two, you know, in the next few years coming together or trying to keep them apart?
I find social media very, very helpful for Burning Man. It doesn't do much to post while you're at Burning Man, but it really helps people prepare, set their expectations for what they need to do and how they need to behave and interact. And that's where I think social media is really useful, informing people as they're arriving about traffic and weather. So we don't really have a problem with it. We just avoid using cell phones when you're at Burning Man.
I think it's great to see the Burning Man pictures afterwards, too, for those of us who don't go. For us, we don't do any real advertising, so social networking is great. It's a free festival. We don't have an advertising budget, so using social media is fantastic. On-site, we have a limited app that we use, so it's great. We have bios of the bands and stuff. And as far as use on site, it's great. Some older bands still don't think they should be filmed, and they don't think they should be taking pictures of, but some of those older bands kind of need to get over that.
So. From my perspective, I think it's great on three points. It's great ahead of time to really get your message out, talk about the event, what to expect at the event. It's great during the event to communicate with your friends or the people who are there and to get information while you're on the site. But it's also become an incredible way to memorialize the event afterwards, which I think was unintended initially. But I know I can experience pride. I'm seeing all these things from Pride that I had no idea were happening while we were out there. So it's an awesome way to see it afterwards.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Amen. Hi, my name is Eamon Armstrong, and I actually work for Fest 300. I work for CHIP. What I love most about festivals is the experience of serendipity that seems to happen there more than elsewhere. That's what's sparked my passion, and I was wondering if, my first question is, do you believe that there is a sort of heightened sense of serendipity at festivals? And if you do believe in it, would you like to share any interesting stories where perhaps you ran into some long-lost friend or some sort of thing just occurred for you that you feel maybe wouldn't have happened in the outside world?
I'm going to start with a potential answer there. So I will tell you, one of my first experiences at Burning Man was soon after a breakup of an 11-year relationship. And Burning Man is, part of the history of Burning Man is, I don't know if we want to say it exactly, but it is an opportunity for people to sort of allow what they need to let go of to go. And that is part of why there's a temple burn, part of why there's a Burning Man burned. So I had a relationship ending. And at some point, I was riding a bike out in the middle of the desert. And this is during the era of Walkman. So I had my Walkman on there, listening to Moby. And who's still around in a big way. But I mean, this was like when he was sort of big time, like 1999 maybe. And I was listening to a song, and I was crying in the desert. And I was wearing some really, like, I don't know, Lawrence of Arabia, like, thing that was flowing out in the, it's like Priscilla, Queen of the Desert kind of thing. And I was on my bike, and all of a sudden, a guy on his bike, who had a Walkman, actually drove up next to me on his bike, and he smiled at me, and for the next 20 or 30 minutes, we just slithered through the desert like two snakes. He was crying too. And one of the 10 principles of Burning Man is immediacy. Mm-hmm. Immediacy basically means learning how to be in the moment and to experience what's happening in the moment. And our lives, our modern lives, are not very much in the moment. They are, you know, looking at that iPhone or, you know, being on our cell phone, whatever we're doing. So I think one of the reasons serendipity happens more often in a festival environment is because we're more in the moment. And there's more of a sense of immediacy that happens in the moment. So, thoughts about that?
Not that.
I get choked up. I mean, I don't have any specific stories. You know, I was in Slovakia at a festival, and I didn't know anybody, and I was totally by myself, and didn't speak the language, and they somewhat speak English. And I just, you know, this happens to me pretty much at every festival for one moment, at least, sometimes more. I just look at the sea of people, and I realize there are so many people that are there together. And they're often there to hear music or express themselves or to be political. And I just think it's really profound. And it usually makes me sort of well up in tears. And that makes me, you know, feel very proud of my festival and the festival work that anybody's doing. I love meeting other festival producers, just to know that there's probably a moment for each of us where you have a chill down your spine and you get sort of choked up because the energy and the intention that people are bringing to it is so powerful.
Hmm. Other thoughts?
Well, I guess the synchronicity goes back to Woodstock, and I was an upstate kid in New York listening to Carlos and seeing Wavy, and I end up out here in San Francisco producing and working and doing shows. And I had no intention of that when I was a kid in upstate New York. So I think that was synchronicity. Mm-hmm. And now I spend a lot of time putting Wavy Gravy on guest lists. you know,
that's great.
That's that. But your feeling is so real. Marion's feeling of being choked up. There's several times during the weekend where it's so mind-blowing that you're in tears. The music or a person or something. There's just so much you're taking back that it's just wild.
Yeah.
Just wild.
I'm glad to know that I'm not the only one who cries at the sight. it's the same. I mean, it's overwhelming. And the moments are often unexpected when they're overwhelming.
A question. We're going to have the next question coming up. Thank you, Eamon. I'm going to ask you a question, and then we'll have someone else join at the mic next. Is there someone else who wants to go? Eric? Yes. What about if you're an introvert in this crowd? I mean, I know I have a lot of friends who say, how do you go to a festival with all those people? How do you have space for yourself? If someone said that to you, what's your number one tip you might give to an introvert for your festival?
Me? You can always go to the back. You can always find a tree. There's always room in the back, and there's always room in the front. Yeah.
I think the bigger the crowd, the easier it is to get lost in it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're more on stage when it's a smaller group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was actually thinking of Pride in the same kind of way. You're in a sea of people, and you're on the street. You can be really inside your own head and be observant, and be an observer and be an introvert. Mm-hmm. Almost easier. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Great. Thank you.
And a big crowd.
I'm Eric Johnson, and I'm on the board of directors at Headland Center for the Arts in Marin County. And what our organization is about is process as opposed to final product. And I'm trying to figure out some festivals or activities that maybe we can model after that are not designed with an audience listening or experiencing a performer, but where it is a completely integral process where everyone is there to participate and collectively create the event. And I know that audience participation is one way to think about it, but outside of audience participation, if everyone comes to the event specifically because they are an integral contributing part of it.
I would suggest, talk about oral, right?
Oral.
Because you're the nice thing at Headlands is you're in a beautiful location.
Right.
You're on the beach, you're at the water, and how could you create a experiential sort of a kind of experience where people stumble upon art and performance art and all kinds of things. That's what happens. Talk about that festival a little bit.
You're in a great location. You should really check out Uru. It reminded me of the Headlands because people would just explore around. They could purchase tickets for little engagements. They used nature. They used the weather. They used surprise. They used different kinds of performers. There was music. There was a very interactive play. We bought tickets for 25 people for a little tiny shack. Larry and I, we thought we'd bought the wrong ones. I said to him, I didn't want to do this little shack thing. And we go into the little shack, and immediately there it only held 40 people, and you were immersed into a story. A toy maker, he's upset with the other people there. They're pulling little toys off and putting tags on the little toys, and a whole pantomime starts happening. And everybody was handed clipboards. They had to fill. I didn't know Dutch. I still don't know Dutch. And you're filling out things, and then there's. And it was really magical. It made us walk out and then start engaging with each other. Like those kinds of engagements, and particularly when you're using the land and using surprise and little tiny spaces. Like you guys have a really great opportunity. You could use the whole area would be beautiful for an engaging festival.
So oral is spelled O E R. O-L.
Oh, yeah.
And you can see it on the Fest 300 site, actually. Oh, what a terrible plug. Yes.
Good evening. My name is Justin Beattie. First question, and I am not a stalker as well. This will be my first Burning Man this year. Very excited for it. If I wanted to stop by and say hello, which camp would you be staying at, Marianne and Chip?
Okay. Well, I stay with Marianne. And first, should I say all this? I don't know.
It is on the radio as well. So
it's for. Oh yeah, that's true.
It's
yes.
Called
for.
It's
at
first
the reception.
Camp.
I'll tell you. At the reception. I'll tell you. But
it's,
I think
it's,
you know,
it's actually not even on the map. There's a name that Larry hasn't chosen yet for our camp
for this year. Yeah. Okay, so let me say this: choosing your camp is a really important component. And there's a post that I wrote last year called An Emotional Survival Guide to Burning Man. Because Burning Man's website has the best survival guide. It tells you everything you need to take.
in terms of all the gadgets, all the gear, etc. The one thing it's missing is it's not warning you about the emotional experience of how to prepare as a virgin. And so I would just say, read the emotional survival guide to Burning Man.
Sorry, my question for the speakers is, thousands of festivals out there nowadays, many of them are just becoming commercialized, and you've done a very good job with building a diverse community that is very unique. From what I've seen, I grew up in Minnesota, been to many country music festivals is what I grew up on. How do you focus on that? How do you stay true to that?
From Pride's perspective, it really is a community event. We have, obviously, the parade. I think there were over 250 contingents in the parade, and those are across the board. From community groups that have been participating since the beginning or new organizations that have joined. The festival site has 23 different stages that community producers come in and do. So while there are only three full-time staff people, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of volunteers that are producing stages, venues, and creating content at the event. So we really are relying on the community to bring that to the table.
I would say, I don't know which one works. Sherry's not surprised. I would say that Sherry and I have been incredibly lucky to have had the same crew that we had, and that they knew Warren and Nosa family, and we've got the strength of that and people who knew the true vision and the vision that we would like to keep. And that keeps us centered, and because we do still have that flame, that we can continue. Mm-hmm. I can speak all day about the cons of festivals who have expensive tickets and sponsorship and all that, but that to me would ruin what we're talking about now.
Your question was about the vision. How do you maintain the vision? At this point, Burning Man sort of replicates that itself. A lot of what I do as an organizer with the other team of organizers is just try and help maintain the container so that we don't have sponsorship, that there's no possibility that we'd see any branding with the event, and there's some framing that we as an organization do. But it really, at this point, to me, is up to the people that enjoy Burning Man to bring the diversity, bring their friends, bring different types of music, bring people from different parts of the world, and we nurture that.
One of the things that I think is fascinating about these three festivals is that if you've never been to it, you have a perspective that it's a certain kind of person that goes to Burning Man, goes to Harley Strictly, or goes to SF Pride. And then you go to the festival for the first time and you're shocked that it's not what you thought. And that's the cultural curiosity piece. That's the part of, like, you know, Burning Man is not just 25-year-old naked people on drugs having sex. It's about 10% of the people who go to Burning Man are in the family camp with kids. There's lots of people over 70 at Burning Man, et cetera, et cetera. Harley Strictly is not just bluegrass people. In fact, that's why the name, it says Harley Strictly. It's not just about bluegrass. And it's probably the most diverse music festival in town. And SF Pride is probably a majority of the people there are not gay or lesbian or transgender or bisexual. Of the 1.2 million, it is...
curious.
Yeah, it's people... it's curious. For sure. That's Marion speaking for herself. But I think I've met so many families from San Jose at SF Pride that it is all kinds of folks. So that's one of the things. Just don't judge a book by its cover when it comes to festivals. So last question before we do a wrap-up question I'm going to ask each one of these three. Go for it. What's your name?
My name is Jason Burton, and thank you for the great presentation thus far. One of the things I've noticed is I've loved festivals from a young age and have gone to many, but each year there seems to be so many more. What are your thoughts around this growth of the quantity of festivals and maybe the level of fatigue around festivals that festivals goers get?
Let me start with an answer on that, because we have studied that. Part of the reason we created Fest 300 was because we saw that in two particular areas, it's crazy. Electronic dance music festivals, EDM festivals, are the fastest growing kind of festivals in the world right now. This is things like Tomorrowland Burning Man's a little bit of that, but in fact, both of these I'm going to talk about it. It's what?
Electric Daisy Carnival.
Carnival, Sensation, Ultra, etc. These festivals are growing so fast, and it's quite a commercial business around that. And then there's transformational festivals of all kinds, which Burning Man is a little bit as well, but there's all kinds of festivals that are really sort of like this place where people go. It's sort of the hippie generation of today, saying, where do we go and feel like we can change the world and change ourselves at a festival? But music festivals are growing, etc. So I think the key about festival fatigue is to not, a lot of festivals tend to be during the better weather months of the year, so they're April to October. And I would just say, first of all, you don't have to spend a fortune to go to festivals. There's so many in your own backyard, whether it's Carnival or Dia de los Muertos. Those festivals, you don't have to go to Mexico or Brazil to have those experience. You can do it right here in the Bay Area. But I would just say pace yourself. I mean, I know you love it, but just like anything, a little bit of moderation can actually make for a better experience. But I'll see what the others say about that as well.
Yeah, to clarify, I'm talking as far as a producer as well, not just a goer.
Got it.
That's a hard question.
Festival fatigue.
I don't actually know how to answer that question.
Well, you get fatigued, and you know that there's an end to it.
Correct. I mean, there's definitely a crescendo with the event. And the work that we do, I can't speak for everyone on the stage, but I know for me, it doesn't leave me a lot of time to go and enjoy other festivals or participate in other ways, for good or for bad.
Got it. Any other thoughts?
My response would be similar. Maybe, I don't know. I don't get really tired of Burning Man. I mean, it's a pretty amazing experience, but I did get weary of being in the trenches of producing it. Because I realized there was a lot of connective activity happening outside in the world, and I feel really fortunate that we've been able to, you know, move around some of our staff so that I've been able to travel, and that's inspired me. So I haven't really had festival fatigue. I get jet lag fatigue, but I'm very inspired by mass gatherings, and it gives me energy to see large groups of people together. And the last little thing, which is my little plug for my little political thing, I'm absolutely certain that if our economy on the world collapses and if things shift and go poorly, that it is the festival producers and the festival culture that will actually make things very peaceful and very connective. Mm. That those that trust others, that have created gatherings of any kind, artistic, street, short, small, large, I think that there will be a peacefulness created by that infrastructure. And that's why I go to other festivals, because I know that the other festival producers and those that know how to gather people together will be very important.
Thank you. So I have a question. This is how we end Commonwealth Club gatherings. It's a question I'm going to ask each of them. You have 20 seconds to answer it, so don't go long. What are your 20-second idea to change the world? George, do you want to start?
I'll start. I don't know that it's an earth-shattering idea, but I think we really need to see things from other people's perspectives. We need to step outside of our own
cultural curiosity.
Exactly.
Mine's trite. I wish people would stop thinking about what other people are eating.
Love that. Okay, we're not going to send you to a food festival.
Marianne? I think part of mine would be cultural curiosity. I actually believe that we can change the world by connecting with each other, coming outside of our homes, and being more communicative and more connective.
Great. Thank you. So thank you. Let's give a round of applause to Marianne, George, and Dawn for spreading the festival love this evening. Now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned, and I have to bang the gavel 3 times. There we go.